to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willens, and this episode's guest, Jeffrey A. Carver. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, and a very special month for The World Shapers podcast. This is Kickstarter month from February 28th. Well, I know you're listening to it after that because I'm recording it on March 7th. Until March 30th at noon Eastern time, I am running a Kickstarter for an anthology called Shapers of Worlds, which is featuring some of the guests that have been on The World Shapers in the first year. It's a very exciting collection of authors. Authors who have agreed to provide original fiction for the anthology include Seanan McGuire, Tanya Huff, David Weber, Ellie Modisett Jr., DJ Butler, Christopher Rocchio, John C. Wright, Shelley Adina, and somebody named Edward Willett. And there'll also be stories, reprints by John Scalzi, David Brin, Joe Haldeman, Julie Cherneda, Fonda Lee, Dr. Charles E. Gannon, Gareth L. Powell, Derek Kunskin, and Thorea Dyer. It's going to be an absolutely fabulous anthology, and I can't wait to publish it through my little publishing company, Shadow Paw Press. So we're about 1 week, as I record this, into the Kickstarter. It is 42% funded. I'm looking for $13,500. More than half of that will go to pay the authors. And I hope that you will consider kicking in. There are some great author... the authors have offered some great rewards for backers, including from David Weber, some first readerships, which is the opportunity to receive his latest book in manuscript form at that same time that he submits it to the publisher. So that's pretty exciting. Fonda Lee, very soon there'll be some books coming from her, hardcovers. We've got signed books from David Brin and Christopher Rocchio and... DJ Butler, and me, of course. and we have some other exciting opportunities there for backers' rewards. So please check out the Kickstarter at tinyurl.com/shapersofworlds. And that will take you there, and you can explore all the rewards and hopefully kick in and help to make this happen. I'm very excited about it. And one thing that I'm doing this month because of the Kickstarter is that there are going to be episodes of the World Shapers podcast every weekend instead of every other week. That does mean that if you are downloading this from the website, you are not seeing a complete transcript. That will come along later. But this week we have Jeffrey A. Carver. Next week, March 14th, we will have Carrie Vaughn. March 21st, it will be the turn of Tim Powers. And then March 28th will be Ira Naiman. So some great authors coming up, one a week, just for this month, while the Kickstarter is live. Once again, the URL for the Kickstarter is tinyurl.com/shapersofworlds. And you can also, if you check out The World Shapers on Twitter, at The World Shapers, or the website, theworldshapers.com, you will see links to this Kickstarter pretty much everywhere that you might find us, including on Facebook, under The World Shapers. Okay, that's what I'm going to introduce this episode with this time around. Let's get on to the meat of the episode, my interview with Jeffrey A. Carver. Jeffrey A. Carver is the author of 18 science fiction novels, including the recently published two-volume epic The Reefs of Time and Crucible of Time, the latest chapters in the Chaos Chronicles, which we'll be talking about in this podcast. Equally popular are his Star Rigger stories, including Dragons in the Stars and the Nebula finalist Eternity's End. He also wrote Battlestar Galactica, a novelization of the critically acclaimed television miniseries. And he's taught writing in a variety of settings, from educational television to conferences for young writers to Odyssey to MIT to his own workshops. His books and short fiction are widely available in ebook, print, and audiobook, and he lives with his family in the Boston area. So, Jeffrey, welcome to The World Shapers.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you. So we're going to start with, it's becoming a cliche on the podcast. I always say I'm going to take my guests back into the mists of time.
I love it.
Which is, you know, further back for some of us than others. And we'll go back and find out a little bit about where you grew up and all that kind of stuff. But primarily, I'm interested in how you became interested in science fiction and fantasy and how you became interested in writing the same. So how did that all come about for you?
Well, let's see. As for where I grew up in Ohio in a town called Huron on the shores of Lake Erie. And I always loved reading, but I always in particular loved reading science fiction. And I don't recall ever not wanting to read science fiction as a young reader. So I can't actually tell you how I became interested in it, because that's what I was drawn to from the very start. And growing up, I, of course, went through my public library's collection, and I looked in particular for those hardcovers with the spaceship on the spine that represented the Winston Juveniles. And then my high school librarian caught on and started putting books in front of me. So it's just how I grew up was as a science fiction reader. I was a big fan of the Tom Swift series and the Tom Corbett Space Cadet series, and then I moved on to the adult stuff.
I was going to ask if there were any specific books that you recall as being particularly influential.
Yeah, I really imprinted on those series. I think the Tom Corbett in particular, at a certain age, probably that certain age was around 12, I'm guessing. And there were a couple of books that really hit me that I would read over and over. One was Stadium Beyond the Stars by Milton Lesser, and some of the early the Heinlein Juveniles, and some of the Asimov and Clark. And then I guess around when I was a high school student, I started to branch out more into wider reading, and then in college. And I think I became interested in writing. Well, my first real attempt was when I was in sixth grade. My best friend and I sat down and decided to write a story together, and we hashed out the plot, and then we each wrote our own version. And I still have that. It's called The Mysterious Midnight Ride, illustrated by the author.
Was it well illustrated?
Well, so yeah, that got me started. And I didn't really try again until I was, a senior in high school. I think we had an English class assignment to write a short story, and I really got into that. And that, I think, is what really triggered the sense that, hey, this is something I want to do.
Did you have a teacher that was supportive of that?
Well, my high school teacher was very supportive of it, but then I went on to college, and I did take some writing classes at the university, and there wasn't really anybody there who was knowledgeable in the science fiction area, so I was kind of on my own for learning how to write science fiction. So I did write some short stories when I was in college, and then at somewhere in those years, the idea cemented itself that this is really what my primary calling was in life. So it took a couple more years after graduation before I actually sold something. And it was really pretty much a solo project for me. And I later became involved in a writing group, which is tremendously helpful. And I wish I had that benefit back in my early learning years.
Well, your degree was actually in English, wasn't it, from Brown University?
Yes, it was. And that was, let's be honest here. I was learning how to, live life and, have fun, which I was not much of a fun person in high school. I was kind of a grind. And so I took a turn, when I was at Brown, and I really focused more on the, the bigger learning about life than on studying my major, which was English.
But then you went on to get a master's in a completely different field.
That is true. One of the things that I began doing when I was at Brown was scuba diving, which you might not think that the waters of Rhode Island are the best place to learn to scuba dive, but it was actually something I enjoyed a great deal. And in those first couple of years of kind of floundering after I was out of school, and I held jobs like substitute teaching and sorting packages for UPS and things like that. I didn't really know what my life calling was that could actually pay a living. So I was looking for a way to kind of tie together my writing interest and my interest in underwater exploration. And I found this program called Master of Marine Affairs at the University of Rhode Island. And that sounded kind of interesting. So I took that. It was a one-year program. And it was really interesting in that I was thrown together with all kinds of people, from hippies to naval officers, from the Naval War College across the Sound. But it did absolutely nothing to move my career forward.
Well, has your wide range of experiences fed into your writing over the years? I mean,
absolutely. In fact, the underwater portion of my hobby, I guess you'd have to say. Although I was a scuba instructor for a little while, but really it was an avocation, and that has fed into a couple of short stories and the full length novel, The Infinite Sea. I think was very much informed by my personal experience of what it's like to be underwater and to experience all of the things that go with that, the darkness and the pressure and the air and the tactile, physical senses of being underwater. So yes, every life experience plays in somehow.
When you, where along in there did you start writing seriously for publication? I assumed you started by attempting and then eventually were published.
Yeah, exactly. Really from the get, I was submitting stories even when I was still in school, and I was getting encouraging rejection slips. Well, at first I was just getting rejection slips and then eventually little notes that encouraged me. So I knew I was doing some things right. But as I said, I didn't really have much external guidance. So it probably took me longer to write a publishable story than it might have. But I sort of had an odd intro into, I guess, the professional end of writing. I had sold two stories, I think, at that point. One was to a very small magazine in Boston called Fiction, and one was to Galaxy, both of those shortly before the respective magazines went under.
I'm sure it wasn't your fault.
I'm sure it wasn't. But I had been submitting regularly to the anthology editors, Robert Silverberg and Terry Carr, who had really well-respected series called New Dimensions for Silverberg and Universe for Terry Carr. And at one point, Terry wrote back to me and said, I like this story. It won't fit my anthology, but I have worked a deal with a new publisher to line up some new writers for a new science fiction line. Would you be interested in writing a novel? I could get you a contract. Write me an outline in a couple of chapters and I'll get you a contract and an advance. And I said, what? And I sat down at the typewriter. I had no intentions of writing a novel until I had a whole bunch of stories under my belt. I sat down and started banging out an outline for a novel that did not even exist in my subconscious until the moment I sat down. And that became Seas of Ernath, which was my first full-length novel.
That is an unusual way to get in.
Yeah, I don't think you can do that today. It's just one of those things.
So how did things develop from there?
Well, once I had that under my belt, I asked, Terry Carr, I asked somebody for a recommendation for an agent, and I contacted the agent, and he said, sure, I'll take you on. Some things were easier in those days. But I did have the book publication under my belt, so it was an easier sell. And submitted a proposal for expanding one of my short stories into a full-length novel to him, and that was sold to Dell Books, which was another interesting sort of little life experience. I knew that he had the book out in submission. I didn't know where it was in submission. I was at a science fiction convention, BossCon in Boston, which I'd only recently started attending conventions, and I found myself in a small room. I really didn't know anybody at this con. And I was sitting with Joe Haldeman and his agent. And I don't know how we wound up in this room together, but we were just chatting and having a good time. And at some point they said, great talking to you. We have this party we need to go to. And I said, would you mind if I tagged along? Because I don't really know anybody. And they said, sure. And I went to the party and was stopped at the door by a stranger who said, I'm sorry, you have to know somebody to come into the party. And then he looked at my name tag and he said, Jeffrey A. Carver. I have your proposal on my desk, and I'm planning to call your agent Monday to make an offer on it. And that was how I met my long-term editor, first at Dell and then at other publishers. That was Jim Frankel, who worked with me on many of these books.
And so things just, you've had quite a few novels over the years since then.
Yes. I'm not what you call a fast writer. In fact, the latest, this pair of novels that came out last year, The Reefs of Time and Crucible of Time, there was an 11-year gap between the previous book and those. Now, that's extreme, and there are a number of reasons why it took me so long. But never in my career did I write fast like some people do. The fastest I ever managed was a book a year, and I didn't sustain that for very long. I'm a slow thinker and a slow, I don't know, it takes me a while to gather the story in my thoughts and put it down.
Well, we're going to talk about your creative and writing process here in a few minutes. I did want to ask you before we got to that, though, you've done a lot of teaching of writing. Yes. I've done some of that. I'm currently writer in residence at the Saskatoon Public Library, so I'm working with a lot of writers who bring me stuff, and I look at it, and I mark it up, and we talk about it, and all that sort of mm-hmm. thing. I find for myself that helping other people with their writing helps me with my own writing. Have you found that over the years as a teacher of writing? Do you learn about writing by teaching writing?
Absolutely. It's funny. When I'm doing a teaching thing, like a workshop, two things happen. One, it really kind of revitalizes me and makes me think again about the fundamentals, and I learn from the students. And that's wonderful. The other thing is that it takes a lot of sort of creative energy to do this, and so I don't actually get much writing done while I'm teaching. But the process is just a wonderful. I really enjoy it. I wouldn't want to do it all the time, but occasionally to dip back in and see how people are coming at it for the first time, and get that fresh sense of perspective from them. It's great.
But I was
also. I'm just going to say that some great friendships have come out of that as well.
I was reading on your website some of your advice to writers, and I thought, I agree with all this. So, you know, you must be a very good teacher because you say the same things I do. So.
Okay. Yeah.
I also wanted to ask you about the Battlestar Galactica novelization. Novelization is not something I've ever done, and I'm always curious about the process of something like that. Now, was this the new Battlestar Galactica, not the original Battlestar Galactica?
Yeah, the new one. The one that came out in 2003, I think it was.
Yeah.
That was something that kind of fell into my lap and was a really fun few months. I had been working long and hard on Sunborn, the fourth book in the Chaos Chronicles, and I just finished the first draft. And the phone rang one day, and it was my editor. And I thought he was calling to say, when are you going to get that book done? But in fact, he was calling to say, would you like to take some time out to write Battlestar Galactica novel? Because he was the editor on the official series. Have you seen this show? And I said, well, you know, because of a fluke in my cable setup, I did see it. I wasn't actually supposed to be getting the Sci-Fi Channel, but because a cable installer made a mistake, I was getting it. So I had seen it. And to my astonishment, I had liked it. Because I really wasn't a fan of the original series. And he said, well, that's great. Would you like to do this? And we went back and forth some, and I said, sure. They needed it fast, and that was good for me. What was interesting was that it used a different subset of my brain cells, I think. The story was already there. I didn't have to devise the story or the characters. They were there. My job was, A, to retell it as vividly as possible and clearly and hopefully exciting manner, but also to see if I could enlarge it in certain ways that would make the novel an interesting addition to someone who had seen the show. In practice, this was very different from what most novelization writers do. Well, no, that part isn't different. What is different is that the show had already aired. And so I had the shooting script and the Bible and all that, but I also had the finished show to work from. Usually guys are writing these novelizations at the same time a show or movie is being shot. So they don't actually have the benefit of the final cut. And I did. So I actually worked somewhat more from the DVD of the show than I did from the shooting script. It was really interesting to see how different this shooting script was from what actually appeared on the screen. There was a lot of kind of reworking done in the edit room, I think.
Which is, I think, why so many novelizations, sometimes you read it and you think, that's not what I actually saw. So,
yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, and it was fun. I enlisted I had a daughter who was homeschooling at the time, and I enlisted her to sit down and watch with me and try to think of places where I could do something interesting. And one thing I discovered was that there would be some scenes that just, they were great on the TV. They flew by, they happened fast, they were exciting. And then when I sat down to write them and think about the logic of them, I thought, you know, this really doesn't hold together. I need to find a different way to tell this because the mediums are so different. So that was a fun challenge too.
Yeah, I would think you could do things visually that if you try to put it in words, yeah, as you said, you start to realize that, well, that wouldn't actually work, or that it couldn't happen that way, or something like that.
Yes. Yes. So you have to find a way to stay as true to the original as possible, but make it hold up.
And I presume there are limits to what you can do with the characters.
Oh, yeah. I had a phone conference with Ron Moore, the creator, co-creator of the show, and my editor, and we went over a bunch of things. But one thing that kept coming up was, well, what can I do about, you're doing some interesting things with religion here. Can I follow that up? Well, no, actually, we're taking that in a different direction with the series. We're not exactly sure where we're going, so better not to do much with that. Okay. What about this guy, Apollo, is pretty interesting. Yeah, don't talk much about his past because we're going to do some stuff with that too. So I had to be really careful. The one thing they did give me license to do was to give a name to Caprica 6, the blonde bombshell who was involved with Baltar before everything blew up. And because she's never given a name until, I think, the last episode of the series, they finally gave her a name. And I said, I can't believe he's having an affair with this woman and doesn't know what to call her. And they said, okay, fine, make up a name for her. And I did, and I ran it past them. And I called, and the name just popped into my head. I called her Natasi. And they said, fine. When the book came out, I think within about 3 days of the publication, someone brought my attention to a website that talked all about BSG. And someone had noted that the name Natasi was I, Satan, spelled backwards. They speculated a bit on the author's intent in doing this. I said, what?
Purely subliminal, I'm sure.
perhaps, yeah.
The only thing like that I've done, there's a children's book series called Beast Wars for like really quite young children, a fantasy series. And I wrote one book in that series. And The one restriction that got me, because it was for young readers, I wasn't allowed to kill anything, no matter how nasty the monster was, or if they were being attacked. I think it was warthogs were attacking them or something, and they could drive them off, but they couldn't actually kill them, even though they had swords and spears and things. So it's always interesting to work inside restrictions that somebody else has set.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to the stuff that doesn't have any restrictions because you write it yourself. An example of your creative process, we will talk about the Chaos Chronicles. I have delved into the first book. I haven't read all the books that are out there. So maybe give a synopsis of what they're about without spoiling anything for people who haven't read them all, like me.
All right. Well, it is a long, I have to admit, complex series, sort of epic galactic adventure. I call it, it's really an odyssey of a company of friends as you stretch past the first book into the ones that follow. Human, alien, AI, they're all exiled from their home worlds. They're facing situations and realities they don't understand. They're thrown into conflict with forces that seem almost infinite and unknowable to them. It's a journey of reluctant heroes. It takes him across thousands of light years, and in these last two books, into deep time. By deep time, I mean billions of years in the past. There are worlds to be saved. They've been volunteered for the job. The books have cool aliens. They have a lot of humor. I hope they have a lot to ponder. Does that help?
That's everything that one holds dear in science fiction. Everything from deep time to thousands of light years to aliens and saving planets. I mean, this is why I got into reading this stuff in the first place.
Yeah, it was definitely informed by my love of classic science fiction.
So tell me how it came about. What was the seed out of which all this grew?
Well, Neptune Crossing got its start. I had just finished a couple of books set in my Star Rigger universe that were long and very intense to write. I think Dragon Rigger was the one that I had just finished. It left me kind of exhausted and happy with what I'd done. But I sat back and I said, this is not a sustainable model for a writing career. It's taken me too long to write. It takes a tremendous amount of emotional energy to do. And that's great for a novel, but not for a career where really you need to kind of have a book a year if you want people to remember you. So I was mulling over what to do about this. And mind you, this was in the early 1990s. It was before we were all used to story arcs in TV shows and things. So this was an epiphany for me, even though it might not have been for someone else. I thought, what if I write a series of short novels that together, taken as a whole, produce this long, complicated book that my brain seems determined to create? Because I just think long and complicated. But what if I break it up into short, snappy novels that I could write quickly, and together they could form that complexity? And so I started working on a sketch. And the other thing that happened was that I was reading an article about chaotic movements of asteroids in the solar system and how from time to time, asteroids and comets, this would fling something into a course that would take it close to the Earth and maybe even hit the Earth. And I'd read with great fascination James Gleick's book, Chaos, about chaos theory. And I thought, well, I wonder if I can put that together with the story I'm sketching out and make something interesting out of the notion of chaos theory underlying other things that happen. And maybe not just the physical outward plot, but what's going on in the character's mind. And those were the two seeds that kind of melded together and formed the beginning of Neptune Crossing. And I had some false starts with that. But then I finally did write it in the space of about a year, and I had great cheers. And I was very pleased with it. And then during the interim, the publisher that had originally contracted for it decided to cut their line back. So it wound up at a different publisher, wound up at Tor Books. And I started the second book, and it was a little longer and more complicated. I didn't mean it to be that way, but it was. And then that was Strange Attractors. And then the third book, Infinite Sea, was just a little bit longer, yes, and they've been growing bit by bit until my original plan to have short, snappy novels has completely fallen apart. But I have a set of novels I'm very happy with. It's just that they're not all short. As short as it. In fact, the two books that were published last year, The Reefs of Time and Crucible of Time, were written as one novel, The Reefs of Time. But it just turned out to be a humongous novel, and I realized it's just not feasible to publish it in one volume, so I split it in two and made clear that this is a two-part story. It is not two separate novels. It's a novel in two volumes.
Was that you'd read a couple of things, they kind of bounce off of each other, and next thing you know, you have a story idea. Is that fairly typical of how stories come to you?
Yeah, I think so. When I think back, I don't remember how all the books got started, but my second novel, Star Rigger's Way, had a minor character in it. Only appears on stage in one chapter, I believe. But years later, his name was LeGroder. Years later, just talking to my editor, and he said, you know, I've always wondered what happened to that guy, LeGroder. You think he might have a story? Because he'd been, when we saw him, he was he was a prisoner of interstellar pirates and being forced to fly ships for them. I thought, well, maybe. And I just sort of noodled that around, and that ultimately became what I called for many years my Flying Dutchman story, because I didn't have a title for it. It was eventually published as Eternity's End, and that was one of my other big, fat books that took years to write, but I was very, very pleased with it once I was done, and it did make it onto the Nebula final ballot, which was very satisfying.
Once you had your initial thoughts, you said you did a sketch. How much pre-planning do you do before you begin writing? It's interesting, and this whole podcast is about process, and I've got everything from people who, just sort of write and see what happens to, I think it was Peter V. Brett who said he writes 150-page outlines before he does any actual writing. So.
I'm much more on the just take the wing and fly and see where you wind up. That doesn't mean that I write without an outline, but my outlines tend to be fairly terse. They sketch out the broad lines of the story, and I generally have a pretty good idea of where I'm headed, but I'm not so sure how I'm going to get there. So I recognize that this isn't the most efficient way necessarily to write a book. I sort of envy the people who can see the whole plot outline and do it in detail ahead of time, because it seems as though it might be a faster and more economical way to write. Well, it just doesn't work for me. I mean, in The Rapture Effect, I think I did a fairly detailed outline and tried to follow it. And then it kept veering from the outline, and I had to figure out how to deal with the fact that I was straying from the outline. So for the most part, I know generally where I'm going, but I'm launching myself into the unknown much as my characters are being launched into the unknown.
What does your actual writing process look like? Do you just sit in a home office? Do you go out to a coffee shop? Do you write down parchment with a quill pen under a tree? How does it work for you?
Maybe I should try that parchment thing. No, I have a home office, and that's where I do most of my work. But sometimes I'll take a writing retreat and just pack up with my laptop and go hole up somewhere for a few days when I really need to get away from daily life and the family. And that, not criticizing my family, I love my family, but it's sometimes hard to get a good, clear focus in the home. So I do find that helpful from time to time.
Like me, you would have started in typewriter days.
Yep. I started with a manual typewriter.
Yeah, me too.
And I remember upgrading to an electric typewriter in the second or third book, I think. And then I got my first computer while I was writing my fourth book, partway into writing my fourth book. That was an Apple II Plus. That was when the very first home computers were coming on. And actually borrowed some money from my father to buy this thing, because it was horrendously expensive, but it just seemed like it would make the process so much better. And it did. But now I don't think all that well with a pen and paper. I think better at a keyboard. For some reason, things come up my fingertips faster than they do, or I don't know, more, it just seems a more open path to me somehow.
Yeah, that's the same for me. My first computer was, writing computer, was a Commodore 64.
Ah,
with a
same
word,
era.
Yeah, word processor that was called Paperclip. And Paperclip allowed you to do 499 lines, was as much as you could put into a file, which worked out to about 10 pages manuscript. So All the books I wrote using my Commodore 64 have 10-page chapters almost to the – they're almost all exactly the same length. So I got it into my head to make chapters about that length. And to this day, I'm probably still writing roughly about that length per chapter, sometimes a bit longer.
Interesting.
Funny what sits into your brain after you get used to something.
Yeah.
I
was just going to say that I used WordStar for DOS for many years, which I think George Martin still uses.
And Robert J. Sawyer.
Yeah. He and I had many conversations about how to do this or that in WordStar, and I loved it. But it started to working less well with each new computer. And finally, I was doing other sorts of work also, and I couldn't keep Windows standard finger commands separate in my head from the WordStar commands, and they just kept conflicting with each other. So I finally said, all right, I'm just going to switch over to Word. And now I do my first drafting in Scrivener and then do final polish and formatting in Word.
Once you have a draft, what does your revision process look like?
Well, my draft goes in front of my writing group. Very small group now. It's just we've unfortunately lost a few members over the years. But they read my drafts and give me critiques. They're professional writers themselves. And I go back. I tend not to take their comments and work on them right away. I note them and move ahead because they see it chapter by chapter as I'm doing it. And then when I reach the end, I start at the beginning and look at what they've suggested. And by then, larger picture things will have come into view that maybe sometimes mean that I throw away long sections. Anyway, and we do it all over again. I send them a few chapters at a time, and at our meetings we discuss it, and they have sometimes some great feedback, great criticisms, great ideas. I can't really imagine writing one of these books without their help.
You had mentioned a particular character that went on to have his own story. How do you find the characters for your story? How do you decide who you need and where do they come from?
They pop out of my head. I don't have any other answer for that, really. They just come to me, including the weird aliens. And my newer books have a lot of weird sort of two-dimensional, pan-dimensional aliens. And I usually don't know when I begin with them what their import is going to be. For example, in the Reefs of Time, there's an animal called a go-cat, which is really it manifests as a more or less two-dimensional creature, but this critter can move across dimensions with ease. It's really brought on board a ship as the pet of another strange alien who's acting as commander. Well, I just brought this go-cat on because I felt that the ship needed an animal. And she went on to play some interesting parts as the story went on, and a crucial part as the story drew toward its climax. And I had no idea of that when I brought her onto the ship. I just thought, need this. So a lot of what happens in my stories is completely intuitive. It happens in my subconscious, and I don't really know what I'm doing until I've written it.
Do you find that you have to do a lot of research for your books?
It depends. When I wrote Neptune Crossing, I did a lot of research on Triton and what it was like.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that one specifically, yeah. Since that's the one I read. So.
Right. And I actually, that was, the Voyager flyby of Neptune was not too far in the past at that point. So I actually got in contact with one of the scientists at JPL from the Voyager project and asked him some questions about what it would look like to be on Triton, and that was helpful. So I do research as needed. I consider my life to be research. When I wanted to have a scene on Triton, you might remember the scene where they're in these crawlers that are mining the surface of the moon. What would that be like? Well, for that, I drew on 2 summers I spent working on an automotive assembly line in Ohio during my college years. And that gave me the look and feel. I knew that wasn't going to be exactly the same process, but I thought that the feel of being in an industrial setting like that, especially being thrown in not knowing exactly what you're doing and being expected to handle machines that are finicky and not terribly user-friendly, that would span all years and locations and be a common experience. So that's the way I wrote that scene.
Once you had your polished draft and submitted it, what kind of editorial feedback do you get? What do you find yourself working on at that stage?
Well, that changes over time. A lot of these books were, I did work closely with Jim Frankel at Tor, and he gave many, many useful suggestions. Some suggestions I would take to mean, okay, you're suggesting that I make a certain change. I don't like that. I'm not going to make that change. But you've pointed out something that isn't working, so I need to find a different change. And often as not, I would take his suggestions to be the cue that I need to rework this somehow. And sometimes his changes were right on, too. So, and other things, I just said, no, I just don't agree with that, so I wouldn't accept it. I've never had the feeling that I was ever being forced into making changes I didn't want. It was always a constructive process. Oops, excuse me, I need to wet my whistle here.
Okay, I'll clear my throat while we're at it. Can edit that out.
Yeah. I'm not used to talking for such length.
So,
But I was going to say that this has changed now. The last two books, well, they were in a I seem to do a lot of things that are in categories of their own. These books actually did have editing from my Tor editor, but in the end, because of the long period of time that had passed, Tor elected not to publish them, and we had an amicable divorce. They gave me back the rights to all the books that they held, and so that I could bring out new editions myself. So I did publish this books 5 and 6 of the Chaos Chronicles under my own imprint, and with the assistance of people from Bookview Cafe, which I'm an author co-op I'm a member of. And so the process of publishing in this case was completely different from the traditional publishing process. And this was the first time I had brought backlist into print on my own, but I had never released a new book on my own. So it was very much a learning experience.
And how was that learning experience? I've started my own little imprint for some things too. So I'm curious what your experience has been.
Well, you know, you have a lot of freedom to do what you want. I commissioned the cover art. I mentioned that I had students who became friends, and one of my former writing students is actually a very talented artist, and he did the cover paintings for the two books. And someone else did the type design for the covers. I appreciated the independence, and I was able to get them out probably a year sooner than they would have been published if Tor had published them. I don't have their ability to distribute widely into bookstores the way they do. So there are pluses and minuses of doing it on your own.
Yeah, that's certainly it's a lot of work. That's one thing.
it really is. That should not be underestimated. Even ebooks are a lot of work.
Yeah. I put out 3 from my little Shadow Paw Press, a collection of my short stories and a reprint of a young adult book of mine that won an award a few years ago, but never had a really good edition. And then I put out my grandfather-in-law's First World War memoirs, which was interesting. And it was kind of one of the main reasons I even started this was because I always wanted to do something with these memoirs, and this was an opportunity for me to bring them out. But it was way more work than I anticipated when I thought, oh, sure, I'll just start my own publishing company.
Yes, yes.
I need a staff, and the cat's no help at all. So
Exactly. And particularly the print editions are very labor intensive. I don't know what platform you used for that.
Ingram.
But for formatting the books.
There's a very good simple program called Vellum for Mac, which does really nice work. So I've used that so far.
Yeah, I downloaded Vellum onto my – I'm a PC guy, but my wife has a Mac. So I actually tried Vellum, and it had some formatting limitations that meant the Chaos books just were not going to work in that.
Yeah.
So I actually typeset those in Microsoft Word, which – to my surprise, is an extraordinarily versatile program for desktop publishing, but it's labor intensive, so it's a slow process. I'm very happy with the way the books look now, but
I know that I'm supposed to learn how to do it in InDesign, but I haven't climbed that learning curve yet.
I think that's a big climb.
I think so too. So the books, any of your books that you've published, this podcast is called The World Shapers. How do you hope shaping the world might be a little grand, but how do you hope they shape or affect readers? What do you hope readers get out of your fiction?
I hope they feel, well, first of all, I hope that they're entertained and that they just find the stories to be exciting and engrossing, and I hope they have trouble putting them down and want to read more. Beyond that, I really hope that they feel kind of, I don't know, uplifted somehow. I have an optimistic streak in my writing that I think there are good things ahead for us. I appreciate the dystopic writers, but I don't do much of that myself. I like to show characters who, however pushed and however difficult it is for them, come to find the better part within themselves. And that's just kind of my worldview, and I hope that my readers will feel the same as they live these characters' lives.
And what kind of feedback have you had from your readers?
Well, the people who write to me are really happy, and I've gotten some great feedback. I'll be honest, I'm not selling as well as I wish they did, but the readers I have seem to really enjoy them, getting great reviews on the various store platforms and places like that. So sometimes, you know, there are two ways of looking at one's success as a writer, and one is to say, to look at how your sales and external recognition is, and another is, are you really reaching people in a way that moves them and touches them in some way, even if it's not so many people? And in my good days, that latter way is how I try to view my writing. I think it's important to touch people and in a good way.
Well, and you talked about, you know, your inspiration is roughly the same era as mine when it comes to science fiction. And when I started reading the first book, Neptune Crossing, and the crawler going across the frozen ice of Neptune and Neptune hanging in the sky, and I just had this feeling of, oh, I'm home. This is science fiction. So it worked for me for sure.
good.
Well, I'm going to go to the big philosophical questions, which okay. I always do that with my voice too. This whole podcast is becoming a cliche. The big philosophical question is, why do you do this at all? Why do you write? Why do you think any of us write? And why specifically science fiction? Why not write, I don't know, cozy mysteries or something?
Yeah. I'll take the last one first. I write science fiction because it's what I love to read. And I enjoy other genres from time to time, but I've just never felt a passion to write any. I've never felt a passion to write a mystery or a thriller. I might someday, not ruling it out. So I write what I want to read. And that is probably a cliche too, but it's really the truth. What was the first question? Why do we write at all?
Yeah.
Yes. You know, I confronted this question after September 11th and the attack on the World Trade Centers. For about a week, I felt absolutely paralyzed as a writer because I thought, what is the point of writing a make-believe story in the face of things like this? And gradually, I came to realize that it is still important because stories are how we communicate the really meaningful things with each other. It's how we interpret who we are as people and who we aspire to be. And sometimes they illuminate who we don't want to be by giving, showing the darker side. And so I think as a sort of general philosophical view, that telling stories to each other is tremendously important. It always has been important from people gathered around campfires to today with our multiple ways of telling stories. We're always telling stories, and something in us drives us to do that. And I just have a stronger drive than the average person, I guess. Not than the average writer, but stronger than there are many people who probably have stories to tell, but for whatever reason haven't decided to sit down and tell them.
What?
Or maybe they tell them in other ways, pass them down through their family lore or whatever.
What do you personally get out of the experience of writing? Do you enjoy it? Is it a slog? What?
Oh, my God. Sometimes I really enjoy it. Sometimes it is a real slog. It can be, it just spans the entire spectrum of emotions. I'd have to say that more than half the time it's painful and it's a slog and difficult for me to do. And then sometimes I'll say, wait a minute, you're supposed to be having fun at this. Have you forgotten that this is supposed to be fun? And I'll think, oh, right. And I'll try to reach out for something in the writing that will kind of re-trigger that. And often, I mentioned going on retreats, sometimes that sort of seeps back in. You know, the daily life, and I have to say this, the internet can really sap a lot of your energy. For all the wonderful things about it, it can kind of sap the joy out of you, especially if you read the news. And then you sit down to write and feel already a little bit depleted. So I do have to reach sometimes to find what was my original desire in writing this story, and how can I bring that into the work I'm doing today? How can I bring that into the scene I'm working on now? And I do find that helpful to refocus that way sometimes. And so the initial drafting is the hardest. It's really like pulling teeth. I don't know what's happening in this chapter until I've written it, and I can't write it when I don't know what's happening, and I go down blind alleys. Once I actually have a draft and I can start shaping it and taking out parts and putting in new parts, I find that more fun, more rewarding. And once I really am starting to see it's like the sculpture is starting to shine a little bit as you polish, then the feeling of satisfaction and reward starts to take the place of the feeling of, oh, I'll never get this written.
Well, one of the interesting things about this podcast and talking to so many authors is the people who really love the first draft, that's the fun part, banging out the story, and then they really hate the revision. And then there's the people who the first draft is the hard one, and then the revision is the part that's more enjoyable.
Yeah,
I guess for me, it falls somewhere. It just depends on the story, I guess. Some stories come easy and some come hard. you've taught quite a bit of writing, as we talked about, and I've mentioned that your advice to new writers is pretty much what I like to tell them. Can you boil that down in a nutshell, what you tell wannabe writers?
Can I look at my page of advice to refresh my memory? One of the things I tell new writers is there's always this, it's like if you gather for advice at a panel at a convention or something. People want to know all about the ins and outs of getting published, or now how to self-publish and how to get known and all that. All of that should come later. Focus on the story. What is the story you have to tell, and what is the best way to tell it? I think it's easy to become trapped into trying to sidestep the process of learning the craft of writing, because it's like any other professional skill. It takes time and dogged effort to learn to write well. There aren't very many of us who are blessed with that ability without having to practice and learn it. And focus on the story. Focus on the heart of the story. Don't focus on becoming rich and famous from your story, your writing. Focus on telling a good story that will touch someone, and let the rest of it, let the chips fall where they may. Now, not that you shouldn't promote once you've written it, but don't let this sort of pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, where everybody's giving you acclaim and money is cascading into your bank account, that's sort of a false god to follow. And you really need to kind of pull back from that and say, okay, story. What is my story? And how do I best tell it?
I'd still like to get to the pot of gold thing, but hasn't happened yet.
No doubt about it. But
And the other advice that I noticed you gave, which I always give, is, well, read. You have to read in the genre you're writing. And and then write.
And read outside the genre, too. You know, it's funny, the reading, I find it harder at my current stage of life to sit down with a book for as long as I would like to read. But a lot of my reading is done now by audiobook. I discovered some years ago that I could listen to audiobooks while I was walking my dogs. And I could download audiobooks from the library or buy them. And so I've become a great consumer of books in that way, which previously I'd had no real interest in. And it really is a very different experience because the narrator becomes sort of a co-author in a way in interpreting the book. And I've come to love audiobooks and, in fact, am getting more and more of my books into audio form.
I was going to ask you that. You have most of your books in audiobook or some still to come?
Some still to come. So some years ago, Audible bought the rights to a bunch of my books through my agent, and those have been up on Audible for a number of years. But my best known books, The Chaos Chronicles and Eternity's End, were not, partly because, I don't know, the rights were not available, or I forget why. But now that I have the rights, I am actually hiring a narrator to record the books, and then I'm putting them up through Findaway Voices and probably be using ACX to get the audiobooks into the maximum number of outlets for people to find them. And that has been another one of my learning experiences over the last year or two, is the best way to take your book and get it into audio. And it's not inexpensive to hire a top narrator. And I have actually hired someone who I believe is one of the best in the business, Stefan Rudnicki, who has done
I know him.
Wonderful narrator. And so we've been working together on the succeeding books of the Chaos series. He just finished recording Sunborn. It's not up yet. The Infinite Sea is just working its way into the various stores. It should be available most places now. And Strange Attractors and Neptune Crossing. I am planning, I'm not sure when this will happen, I'm planning to run a Kickstarter campaign to see if I can raise the money to hire him to do the last two books.
Well, and that segues nicely into the last thing I want to ask as we come to the end of the hour, which is, what are you working on now?
I'm working on the last book of the Chaos Chronicles, book 7, called Masters of Shipworld.
And that will wrap it all up?
I think so. Although various people have pointed out to me, you know, you could take this character and write a series of stories about that character. If you've read Neptune Crossing, you know that he has a niece named Dakota Bandicoot, who's back on Earth. Well, she comes into the Reefs and Crucible of Time and has her own life. This turns out to be pretty interesting. So that's a way I might go. I don't know. We'll see what the future brings.
Do you have a end date and time for the new book?
I never do that anymore. I've learned my lesson. I don't give end dates and times.
And where can people find you online?
My website, starrigger.net. I'm also on Facebook, but to a limited degree. My blog on starrigger.net goes to Facebook. So that's really how most people hear whatever I have to say from time to time.
And your blog, you're fairly active on there. You post regularly, don't you?
Yeah, a couple times a week I try to, yeah.
So that would be the place to find you, for sure.
By all means. Yeah, and you can sign up for my occasional newsletter on my website also, and I would encourage people to do that.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for being on The World Shaper, Jeffrey.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been, either way is fine. That hour went fast. Surprised to see we've been on for an hour. I really enjoyed it, and hope to talk to you again soon.
I hope so, too. Bye for now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks again to Jeffrey A. Carver for being my guest on this episode of The World Shapers. I enjoyed that chat a lot. I hope you did, too. Once again, this is the special Kickstarter month at The World Shapers. I am kickstarting an anthology of guests from the first year of the podcast. Some great authors in there providing new fiction, others providing reprints. And because of this being Kickstarter month, you can now look forward to 1 week from today on March 14th or 15th, it will go live. You'll see the podcast featuring Carrie Vaughn. A week after that, I have the great Tim Powers. And the week after that, Ira Naiman. So that's what we have lined up in March as this Kickstarter continues. Again, to find the Kickstarter, you just have to find the World Shapers online. The World Shapers is on Twitter at The World Shapers. It is on Facebook at The World Shapers. And it is on the World Wide Web at theworldshapers.com. You can find me on Twitter at eWillett. You can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. Two T's on Willett. Always remember that. And you can find me at edwardwillett.com. The direct URL for the Kickstarter, if you'd like to kick in and help make it happen, is tinyurl.com/shapersofworlds. And I think that covers it for this week. The one thing I have not mentioned is that the World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, and one of our sponsors is Kinexus Credit Union. That's it for this time. I hope you will come back next time as I chat with urban fantasy legend Carrie Vaughn. Bye for now.